Behind these rafters hadn't had convenience skulking in mind. Setting climbing hooks around each of his wrists, Durzo wedged his fingers where two beams came together at an angle. It was painful, but a wet boy learned to ignore pain. He swung out over space, letting his feet release the beam. He wondered what the fat noblewoman below him would think if her dinner were suddenly crushed by a falling shadow. He held his entire weight by his fingertips and used his weight to wedge his fingers deeper into the painful crack, then released his right hand and swung to grab the other side of the joint, past the solid surface where all the beams came together. He had only his long reach to thank for making it. He got three fingertips into the crack on the far side of the beam. As he shifted his weight, the dust in the crack was just enough to slide his fingertips off. Blint rolled his wrist forward as his fingers slipped. He dropped 3 inches, and then the wrist hook caught in the crack his fingers had just left. The hook held. Blint released his left hand, and his body swung again. Now he'd fall directly on the woman instead of on her food. He pulled against the iron hook, biting into his wrist, and was able to reach high enough to grab with his fingers. He swung again, pulled out the hook, and grabbed the edge of the beam with his other hand. He hung there, fingertips holding his entire weight from the same side of the beam, and the grip slick with an inch of dust. Had he thought he liked his work? But with practiced grace, he swung sideways and caught the edge with a foot. Deftly, he wriggled back up onto the beam, ignoring the dust he pushed off the beam as he did so. Some risks you can't help, and some you can. I haven't exactly minimized my risks, have I? Durzo tried not to think about it, but scooting along the beam, acting like a cleaning lady, didn't take his full attention. He'd given Kylar all the hints he needed to interrupt what Roth had planned here, and he'd given him motive to make sure he came here rather than leaving town. It's bad luck, old boy. But what was bad luck to him now? He was going to lose no matter what. At the head table, the king stood. His face was flushed, and he wobbled. He raised his glass. My friends, my subjects, today is Midsummer's Eve. We have much to celebrate and much to mourn. Words have abandoned me in light of what's happened in the last day. Our kingdom has endured the grievous loss of Katrina Gyre and her entire household at the hands of her murderous husband, and the loss of our beloved prince. The king choked out the words, and his emotion was so obvious that not a few eyes brimmed with equal tears. The prince had been young and dashing, if unwise, and the Gyres had been respected for decades personally and for generations familially.
Today, we gather to celebrate Midsummers. Some might wonder why we celebrate in the shadow of such dark deeds. I'll tell you why. We wish to celebrate the lives of our loved ones, not yet mourn their deaths.
On the king's left hand, Lord General Aegon was nodding his head with grim approval. Durzo wondered how much of this speech was Aegon's. Most of it, he suspected. The king drank from his glass, forgetting that he was in the middle of a toast. The nobles throughout the room looked confused. Should they drink? Or was the king not finished? Half chose each, but the king continued, gaining volume.
I'll tell you why we're here. We're here because the bastards who murdered my boy aren't going to stop me. They aren't going to get me. They aren't going to stop me from doing whatever the hell I please.
Lord General Aegon looked alarm. Aeline the Ninth had slipped into the first person singular from the royal plural. He must have had more to drink than was apparent.
"And I'll tell you what is our sovereign pleasure. There are schemers, plotters, traitors! Here tonight, yes! And I swear to you, traitors, you will die!"
The king had gone purple with rage.
"I know you're here. I know what you're doing. But it's fucking not going to fucking work!"
"Well, look who learned a new word."
"Now! Sit down, Brant!"
the king shouted as the Lord General stood. The nobles were stricken silent.
"Some of you have betrayed us to Calador. You've murdered our prince. You've killed my boy. Logan Gyre, stand!"
Cyra Drake was sitting near the back, according to her rank, but even from above, Durzo could see the terror on her face. She thought the king was going to have Logan executed publicly. And she wasn't alone. Logan Gyre stood, shaken. He was handsome, and from what Durzo knew, formidable, and popular with both the assembled nobles and the small folk of the city.
"Logan!" the king shouted. "You've been charged with my son's death! And yet here you are tonight, celebrating! Did you kill my boy?"
Several nobles cried out in alarm, shouting that Logan would never be involved in such a thing. The king's soldiers looked scared. They looked to Captain Arturian for guidance. He nodded, and two guards stepped up beside Logan.
"Well," Durzo thought,
finally coming directly over the head table where the king and Logan were seated.
"If threats don't make Kylar want to kill me, this will. The innocent always lose."
"Let him speak!"
the king roared. He let off a stream of curses, and the crowd quieted. The tension hung thick over them. Logan spoke loudly and clearly.
"Your Majesty, your son was my friend. I deny all charges."
The king was silent for a long moment. Then he said,
"I believe you, Duke Gyre."
He turned to the nobles.
"Lord Gyre has been found blameless in our sight. Logan Gyre, will you serve your country at all costs?"
Durzo paused, as stunned as the nobles were.
"I will."
Logan spoke clearly, but there was obvious tension in his face. His eyes had locked on Cyra Drake's. What the hell is going on? This had the feel of something scripted.
"Then, Lord Gyre, we pronounce you Crown Prince of Cenaria, and we announce your marriage of this afternoon to our own daughter, Janine. Logan Gyre, you shall be our heir until such time as an heir is born to our royal house. Do you accept this duty and this honor?"
"I do."
The apprehension in the great hall had turned to disbelief. Then awe. Janine Gunder moved to stand beside Logan, looking as awkward as a 15-year-old can. Durzo heard a little cry from Cyra Drake. Her hands flew up to her mouth. Then she fled. But nobody besides Logan and Durzo noticed, because even as she ran for the exit, a cheer broke out, rapidly spreading to every throat. The king tossed off his wine, and the nobles joined his toast, saluting Logan.
"Prince Gyre! Prince Gyre! Logan Gyre!"
The king sat, but the cheering continued. All eyes were on Logan and Janine. The king looked irritated that the nobles were chanting Prince Gyre instead of the traditional Prince Logan, might have been simply because it was easier to chant, but it also drove home that Logan wasn't a Gunder, and everyone was happy about it. Logan graciously, if somewhat woodenly, accepted the applause, nodding to his friends. Then he blushed as his new wife took his hand. Her face glowed with embarrassment at her own boldness and adoration for her husband. The nobles loved it. But as the approval roared to a crescendo, the king looked more and more vexed. And still the cheering continued. The servants were cheering. The guards were cheering. It was as if the nobles felt a black cloud lifting from their futures. Not a few were saying, "What a king Logan Gyre will make!" Hurrahs rang of it. Aelin Gunda was turning purple again, but no one was paying him the slightest attention.
"Prince Gyre! Prince Gyre! Long live Prince Gyre! Hurrah!"
The king jumped to his feet, apoplectic.
"Now go! Go consummate this marriage!"
he shouted at Logan, who wasn't 5 paces away. Lord General Aegon stood, but the king shoved him away, roughly. Logan looked at Aelin, shocked. The nobles quieted.
"Are you deaf?"
the king shouted.
"Go fuck my daughter!"
The princess turned white. So did Logan. Then he flushed red, mortified. She looked like she wanted to sink through the floor. At the same time, barely controlled rage washed over Logan's face in a crimson wave. The honor guards on either side of him looked stunned. Durzo wondered if the king had gone mad. The nobles didn't make a sound. No one even breathed.
"Out! Get out! Go fuck! Go fuck!"
the king yelled. Trembling, livid, Logan looked away and led his wife from the hall. The nervous guards followed.
"And the rest of you," the king said. "Tomorrow we mourn my son, and I swear that I'll find out who killed my boy if I have to string up the lot of you."
The king sat abruptly and started weeping like a child. Durzo had frozen in place for the entire exchange. The nobles looked baffled, horrified. They slowly sat, staring at the king in silence. Durzo's mind was racing. Roth hadn't foreseen this. Couldn't have. But Durzo was sure that Roth was in the castle, maybe in this very hall. A guard with one of the minor nobles was their signal man. If he took off his helmet, the coup was off. It gave him a moment to digest what had just happened. Not the king's madness, but Logan's marriage. It was a brilliant bit of intrigue. Now if the king were killed, instead of 4 houses having equal claims while Logan Gyre rotted in the maw, Logan Gyre would clearly be the king. With his reputation and the endorsement of the Gunders, he would get quicker obedience from the noble houses than even King Gunder had. It was a brilliant move. But it was too late. Roth had men throughout the castle. He probably couldn't afford to try again later. If the coup had been planned for tomorrow, Logan's marriage might have changed everything. As it was, Logan and Janine would just be added to the list of those who had to die. As Durzo waited, it appeared that Roth agreed. A servant approached the signal guard and spoke with him. The man nodded and kept his hands off his helmet. The coup was on. Whatever Roth would have to fix, it would involve killing Prince Logan Gyre now, who would be conveniently tucked away in the North Tower, where he'd be easy to find. Roth would probably want to assign that job to Durzo, but Durzo had no intention of giving the Caladoran a chance. He would do what he had promised, but he wouldn't kill Kylar's friend. During the first course, the nobles had already eaten the rabbits Durzo had prepared. He'd been feeding those rabbits hemlock for a year. The amount in a portion was a small enough dose that nothing would happen to the diners unless they'd also eaten the starling appetizers. In less than a half hour, the nobles would feel ill. Hemlock poisoning started peacefully enough. Already, the nobles' legs should be losing feeling. If anything, they might notice that their legs felt heavy. Soon, the feeling would spread up. Then they'd start vomiting. Anyone unlucky enough to have eaten seconds would begin convulsing. The timing now was tricky. Poisoning wasn't an exact science, and someone might notice something amiss at any time. Durzo needed to act before that happened. He secured one end of his rope to the beam. It was black silk, ridiculously expensive, but the slenderest and least visible rope Durzo owned. Fixing the harness he'd designed specifically for this mission, Durzo wrapped the rope through it and slid off the beam. Steadying his swaying against the beam, Durzo looked down at his target. The king was directly below him. Durzo tucked in his knees and folded over. The harness bit into his shoulders, and he let out slack, slipping down toward the floor, head first. Now, timing was everything. In one hand, Durzo held the rope. By adjusting its position and tension against the harness, he could dive quickly toward the floor, or stop easily. When he moved, he would need to move quickly. He was shrouded in shadows so that he was barely visible, but he couldn't shroud the rope. In a room this cavernous, a rope swaying above the king as if holding weight would be noticed. The king's guards were good. Vin Arturian made sure of that. With his other hand, Durzo pulled out two tiny pellets. Both were compounds from various mushrooms. Durzo had been able to make the pellets tiny, but they didn't dissolve quickly, and for this job, he couldn't use a powder. The nobles were still silent. The king was barely crying now, but he noticed the nobles looking at him.
"What are you staring at?" he shouted.
He cursed them roundly.
"This is my daughter's wedding feast! Drink, damn you! Talk!"
The king drained his wine again. The nobles pretended to be talking, and soon that pretense became a furor of speculation. Durzo imagined that they were wondering if the king had lost his mind. He wondered the same himself. He wondered what they'd think after the king drank his next goblet of wine. A servant came and filled the king's goblet. The king's cupbearer sipped the wine first and swished it around his mouth. Then he gave it to the king, who set it down on the table with a thump.
"Your Majesty,"
Lord General Aegon said at the king's left hand,
"may I have a word with you?"
The king turned, and Durzo pushed the rope forward. He dropped like a bolt. 10 feet above the table, he pulled the rope back and jerked to a stop. 10 feet was still a long way to drop something so light, but he'd been practicing. But as he tightened the rope, it twisted, and suddenly he was spinning, not fast, but spinning. It didn't matter. There was no time to try again. The first pellet splashed solidly in the center of the king's goblet. The second hit the edge and tinged off. The pellet rolled several inches across the table by the king's plate. Durzo coolly drew another pellet and dropped it in. The king picked up the goblet and was about to drink when Lord General Aegon said,
"Your Majesty, perhaps you've had enough to drink."
He reached a hand to take the goblet from the king. Durzo didn't waste time seeing what the king would do. He drew a short tube from his back and looked beyond Aegon to the king's mage, Fergund Safasti. He saw the man, but the rope spun him away before he could shoot the blow dart. He was trying for a leg shot. His hope was that the hemlock would have deadened the mage's legs enough that he wouldn't even notice the ting. But on the next rotation, he didn't have a clear shot because the king and the Lord General were gesticulating wildly.
"Damn robes!"
The mage's robes left barely 6 inches of his calf visible. Durzo came around again and abandoned the calf shot. The mage had shifted his feet, and Durzo only had one of the darts, whatever they were baited with. It was a Caladoran secret that was supposed to disable the mage's magical abilities. Durzo puffed on the blowgun. The dart stuck into the mage's thigh. He saw a brief flash of irritation on the man's face. The mage reached down toward his thigh and was jostled by the Sakage servant.
"Sorry, sir. More wine?"
the man asked the mage, snatching the dart.
He was good. With hands like that, he must be one of the best cut purses in the city.
But of course, Roth would only use the best.
"Mine's full, you idiot," the mage said. "You're supposed to serve the wine, not drink it."
Durzo flipped over and scrambled up the rope. Not an easy feat with silk. He rested when he got onto the beam. He had no idea if the king had drunk the wine or not, but his part was done. The only thing to do now was wait.
Chapter 52.
"Drink yourself blind, then,"
Aegon said.
He didn't care if the king heard him. He didn't care if the king killed him.
"Just when I thought I could deal with this bastard. He disgraces his own daughter and shames a man who's given everything he loves to serve the throne."
Aegon had been able to steer the king through the marriage of Logan Gyre and Janine Gunder. But the king had hated the idea. He was jealous of Logan's looks and intelligence, jealous of how much people approved of his choice, and angry that Janine had been excited to marry Logan rather than resigned to it. But if Aegon had done one valuable thing in his 10 years of serving this hell-spawned brat, it had been convincing the king to appoint Logan crown prince. Not that Logan would ever forgive him, but it was for the good of the realm. Sometimes duty required a man to do things he would do almost anything to avoid. It had been duty that had compelled Aegon to serve Aelin the Ninth, and only duty. Like Aegon, Logan wasn't a man who would shirk his duty, but also like Aegon. That didn't mean he had to like it. Logan would probably hate Aegon for the rest of his life, but Senaria would get a good king. With Logan's intelligence, popularity, and integrity, the country might even become something more than a den of thieves and murderers. Aegon was willing to pay the price, but it didn't sit well with him. He'd seen himself in Logan's eyes, realizing he was pledged to a destiny he would never have chosen. He'd seen the look on Cira Drake's face. Logan would live with the guilt of that betrayal for the rest of his life. The sight had seared him. Aegon had barely been able to touch his food tonight. The king tossed back the rest of his wine. The nobles were still buzzing. It wasn't the pleasant hum of conversation usual at Midsummer's Eve. Their tones were hushed, their glances furtive. Everyone offered an opinion on what the king was doing, why he would appoint an heir, and then insult him in the same breath. It was madness. Slowly, the king emerged from his tears and silence. He stared around the great hall with hate-filled eyes. His lips moved, but Aegon had to lean close to hear what he was saying. He wasn't surprised to hear the king muttering curses, one after another, droning on and on, mindless in his rage. Then the king burst out laughing. The hall quieted once more, and the king laughed louder. He pointed at one of the nobles, an unassuming count named Burrs. Everyone followed the king's finger and stared at Count Burrs. The count stiffened and reddened, but the king said nothing. His attention wandered, and he started cursing to himself again. For long moments, nobles continued staring at Count Burrs, then looked at the king.
Then, Chancellor Stigler, who was seated at the head of the table,
stood up with a cry and shouted, "There's something in the food!" The Chancellor tottered and collapsed back into the chair, his eyes rolling up in his head. Next to him, a man the king had always hated, Lord Rule, suddenly slumped forward. His face smacked into his plate, and he lay still. The king laughed. Aegon turned to him. The king wasn't even looking at Lord Rule, but the timing couldn't have been worse. Someone cried, "We're poisoned! The king has poisoned us!" Aegon turned to see who had shouted, but he couldn't tell. Had a servant said it? Surely no servant would dare. Another voice took up the shout. "The king! The king's poisoned us!" Laughing, the king jumped to his feet and stumbled drunkenly. He shouted obscenities as the great hall erupted in chaos. Chairs squeaked as lords and ladies stood. Some of them wobbled and fell. An old lord started retching onto his plate. A young lady collapsed, vomiting. Aegon was on his feet, shouting orders to the soldiers. The side door by the head table burst open, and a man in gyre livery pushed in, holding his hands up to show he was unarmed. His livery was torn and bloody. A gash bled beside his eyes, streaming blood down his face. Gyre livery? None of Logan's servants were here tonight.
"Treachery!" the servant shouted. "Help! Soldiers are trying to murder Prince Logan! The king's soldiers are trying to murder Prince Logan! We're outnumbered! Please help!"
Aegon turned to the king's guards, drawing his sword. "There has to be some mistake. You, and you, come with me." He turned to the bleeding messenger. "Can you take us to the—"
"No!"
the king bellowed, his laughter instantly turning to rage.
"But, sire, we have to protect—"
"You will not take my men. They will stay here. You will stay here, and you, Brant, you're mine. Mine! Mine!"
To Aegon, it seemed he saw the king for the first time. He'd seen Aelin the Ninth as a foul, wicked child for so long that he'd forgotten what a foul, wicked child with a crown could do. Aegon looked to the king's guards. Disgust was written on their faces. He could tell they ached to go defend Logan, their prince, but duty forbade them from disobeying their king. Logan. Their prince. Suddenly, it became so simple. Duty and desire became one for the first time in years.
"Captain Arturian!"
Aegon barked in his command voice so that every royal guard heard him.
"Captain, what's your duty if the king dies?"
The squat man blinked.
"Sir, my duty would be to protect the new king, the prince." "Long live the king!"
Aegon said. The king was staring at him, confused. His eyes widened as Aegon's sword swung back. Aelin was halfway through a curse when Aegon's sword struck his head off. King Aelin Gunder the Ninth's corpse hit the table and knocked over chairs before coming to rest on the floor. Before any of the guards could attack him, Aegon raised his sword over his head with both hands.
"I'll answer for this, I swear. Kill me if you must, but now your duty is to the prince. Save him!"
For a second, none of them moved. The rest of the panic in the hall seemed far away, the ladies screaming, men shouting, servants armed only with meat knives trying to defend their retching lords, shouts of "Treachery!" and "Murder!" ringing in the air. Then Captain Arturian shouted,
"The king is dead! Long live the king! To the prince! To King Gyre!"
Together, Aegon, the king's guards, and a dozen knife-wielding nobles ran from the great hall. Before Kylar got within sight of West Kingsbridge, he slowed to a walk. He willed himself to be a shadow, and looked at himself. he looked like a raggedly cut piece of darkness. That was good. Durzo had told him that the ragged edges obscured the humanness of his figure and made a wet boy harder to recognize. Kylar thought that his talent would also be muffling his steps. He wanted it to, but he had no idea if it was. He couldn't afford to find out the hard way. He rounded the corner and saw the guards. West Kingsbridge was controlled with a large gate, like the castle's own gates. Hand-thick oak reinforced with iron, 20 feet high and spiked along the top, with a smaller gate inset. The big mailed guards looked nervous. One was fidgeting, awkwardly turning his whole head to look to the sides. The other was more calm, pointedly staring every direction except down the river. Kylar came closer. He recognized the men despite their helmets, and not only because the twins had matching lightning bolt tattoos on their faces. They were bashers, and good ones. Lefty, he was the one with the crooked nose, and Bernard. Kylar looked where Bernard wasn't looking. In the darkness, an unwieldy barge squatted on the river like a beached sea cow. Its doors were open, but no one held any lights. But darkness no longer affected Kylar's eyes. If he'd had more time, he would have marveled about that. As night fell, if anything, his vision improved as the shadows became more uniform. Through the open doors of the barge, he saw rank upon rank of soldiers. Each wore Cenarian livery, but with a red kerchief tied around one arm. Common soldiers with kerchiefs on their left arm, officers with them on their right. The soldiers weren't Cenarian. Under their helmets, secreted in the shadows of the night, Kylar saw the stark, cold features of Northmen, hair as black as a raven's wing, and eyes as blue as frozen lakes. They were big, raw-boned men, weathered and hardened from exposure to the elements and battle. So they weren't just Caladorans. They were Caladoran Highlanders, the God King's fiercest, most elite troops, all of them. In the daylight, that would be obvious to any Cenarian in the castle, but at night, it would take time for the Cenarian soldiers to realize that they were being attacked by a foreign enemy. The Cenarian soldiers would figure out that the armbands were what the Caladorans were using to identify each other, but it would take time. Each new group that encountered the Caladorans would have to learn it for themselves. Kylar saw another barge pulling up the river, only 100 paces away. Caladoran Highlanders tended to be broader and deeper of chest than most Caladorans, and while a few free tribes still held out in the mountains, those who had been absorbed into the Empire had become its most feared fighters. 400 or 500 Highlanders. Kylar couldn't tell, but he guessed that the other barge was full of the elite soldiers, too. If so, Calador meant to take the castle tonight. The rest of the country would crumple like a body deprived of its head. Several witches were talking as they climbed the switchbacks from the water up to the bridge. They were scanning the sky over the castle, apparently looking for some sign. Indecision held Kylar frozen. He had either to get inside to save Logan. Surely Roth would have either Hugh or Durzo kill all the dukes, especially after all of Logan's fighting on the Caladoran border. Just as surely, the murder would happen shortly, if it hadn't already. Kylar could go inside and try to stop the hit, or he could try to oppose the Caladorans out here. By myself? Madness! But just watching the barge pull closer to the bridge made him furious. He knew he should feel no loyalty to Cenaria, but he was loyal to Logan and Count Drake. If this army got into the castle, it would be a massacre. So he needed to fight inside and outside. Great!
Kylar looked at the Sakage imposters manning the bridge. Bashers wouldn't know or care about the bridge's defenses, much less have the discipline to dismantle them. All they had done was turn the crank that lifted the massive iron river gate. Then, in the sky above the castle, Kylar saw a long arc of blue-green flame. He started walking. The witches looked pleased. They confirmed with an officer, who started barking orders. One of the Caladorans raised a torch and waved it twice. Lefty and Bernard took torches of their own, walked to either side of the bridge, and waved twice. All clear. Right. Kylar drew retribution. As it hissed out of the scabbard, the bashers turned. Lefty blinked and leaned forward. With the torches in their hands blotting out their night vision, all they saw was a thin strip of dark metal bobbing and floating through the air. Then it moved with terrible speed. In a moment, both men were dead. Kylar replaced the torch he'd plucked from Bernard's hand and checked the men on the barges. They had already formed up and were walking, single file, up the narrow switchbacks that led to the bridge. Grabbing the keys off Bernard's body, Kylar opened the gate and slipped through the inset door. The crank and the release for the river gate were there. The gate itself was simply a massive, counterweighted portcullis that could drop into the water. In this case, onto a ship. Kylar threw the release. The river gate dropped 2 feet and didn't crunch. It clanged. Kylar looked over the side of the bridge. The river gate had slammed down onto magical stops that glowed and sparked in the darkness. Witches were on the deck of the first barge, shouting. He ran into the guard station. There was a fire pit with a cauldron full of stew, cooking paraphernalia, a helmet, several cloaks, chests for the men's personal belongings, and a set of knuckle bones on the low table. There was a closet full of old broad carpets stuffed in fat buckets. Kylar rushed out of the guard station. Surely the king wouldn't have left his military bridge with only that defense. The pilings of the bridge were wood, sheathed in iron, impervious to fire. The sheathed wood still got wet, but couldn't breathe and release the water it absorbed, so every beam rotted within years and had to be replaced. Why would the king be so particular about fire? And then Kylar saw why. Along either side of the bridge were long wooden beams set on pivots. On the end of each beam was a huge clay globe, as wide as Kylar was tall. At least part of the clay was molded over iron, because a mooring rope was tied to an iron loop at the top of the globe. Several small handles also protruded from the sides. Pulling on one handle, Kylar found a bracket. As he slid it out, a wash of oil fumes swept over his face. It took him several precious seconds of staring at the entire contraption to understand. The arms would swing out over the side of the bridge, holding the globes full of oil, then drop them onto any boat passing underneath and hopefully set it on fire in spectacular fashion. He rushed back to the gate and grabbed the torches the guards had been carrying. He closed and locked the gate quickly. The advance party of Caladorans were almost to the bridge. What am I doing? The first barge was just starting under the bridge. There was no time. Kylar kicked a safety latch holding the beam in place and pushed on it. It didn't move. He stumbled and almost tripped over taut ropes at his feet, cursed, and flung himself against the beam again. Hadn't the damned soldiers ever greased this thing? Finally, it occurred to him to use his talent. He felt power flowing through him. He could lift a wagon on his back. He pressed against the beam and could feel himself shimmering, the ragged black covering and uncovering his skin as he redirected his talent. If I'm lucky, they won't even know I'm here until it's too late. A ball of crackling green witchfire flew over the globe, missing it by a yard. Yells sounded from below. Whether the witches saw Kylar or just his torches, they weren't pleased. Kylar pushed against the beam, but with nothing to brace his feet against, he just slid across the planks. The beam barely moved. A ball of witchfire caromed off the globe and ricocheted up into the sky. Kylar ignored it. Something white was blooming above the deck of the barge, now directly under him. A small creature took shape in front of a red-haired witch and flying up like a hummingbird. The witch chanted, his vermarks thick with power, directing the creature. Kylar heaved, and the ropes at his feet tripped him hard. The homunculus took shape as it zoomed toward Kylar. It was small, barely a foot tall, and pasty pale. It wore the likeness of the red-haired witch, like ill-fitting clothes. It landed on the globe gently, and then rammed steely claws into the iron as if it were butter. It turned to Kylar and hissed, baring its fangs. Kylar scuttled back and almost fell off the edge of the bridge. A concussion thudded below. The air in front of the red-haired witch rippled like a pond absorbing the shock of a thrown rock. Something was moving, as if it were just under the surface of the air. Something huge. Reality itself seemed to be stretching and tearing. Kylar saw hell and rushing skin as reality itself rippled under the pressure of the worm's passage. It was coming for him. 20 feet from him, reality flayed and tore. Kylar had one glimpse of a gigantic, lamprey-like circular mouth. It seemed to throw its mouth inside out in a spiny cone. Then, the narrowest ring of teeth hit the homunculus, and the teeth snapped in the opposite direction, tearing into the pasty creature. Each successive circle of teeth pulled and snapped into everything surrounding the homunculus with hideous strength, the cone inverting, sucking everything in. The last, widest row of teeth snapped closed on the widest part of the iron globe, and the pitworm whipped back into its hole as suddenly as it had emerged. The air rippled again, and then faded, as if nothing had happened. The homunculus was gone. So was three-quarters of the globe. Clay crunched and iron sheared off as if it were lard. Oil dribbled into the water beside the barge. The soldiers cheered. The first barge had passed the bridge, and the second barge was just emerging. Feeling weak, Kylar scooted back and almost fell on ropes again. He cursed loudly. Then his eyes followed the ropes. They were connected to a pulley system attached to the beam. I'm an idiot! Grabbing a rope, Kylar pulled it, hand over hand, as fast as he could. The arm supporting the second globe swung out over the side of the bridge smoothly and easily. Kylar heard a yell, and two green missiles flew past. Next to the pulley, there was another rope. Thin. Probably important. Kylar yanked it, and the beam holding the clay globe suddenly dropped. The globe dropped with it. For a moment, Kylar was afraid that he'd just dropped his only weapon straight into the water, but the mooring rope swung the globe like a pendulum a foot above the river. The globe slammed into the second barge at the waterline. There was no explosion. The side of the boulder that struck the barge was iron beneath a patina of fired clay. It burst through the side of the barge as if the hull were birch bark and blasted through crowded ranks of Highlanders. The rest of the globe was clay. It disintegrated. The oil that filled the globe splashed violently over men and their gear, soaking the wood decks. Kylar looked at the barge from above. A nice hole gaped at the waterline, and the men inside were screaming. But he'd hoped for something more
Boom!
The barge exploded. Flames leaped out of the holes the globe had made and tore it to three times its original size. Fire burst from the portholes. The doubled and redoubled screams of men were swallowed in the sudden roar of flames. Men who'd been standing on the deck of the ship were thrown off their feet, and not a few of them into the water. Their armor dragged them hopelessly under the gentle waves. As quickly as it had sprung up, the gush of fire disappeared. Smoke continued to roll out of the portholes, and men were streaming up onto the deck. The barge listed heavily. An officer, bleeding from a gash on his head, was bellowing orders, but to no avail. Soldiers leapt from the deck to swim for the shore that looked so close, and dropped like rocks. The water wasn't deep, but with heavy armor, it was deep enough. Having paused for several moments to turn from feeding on oil to feeding on wood, the fire advanced again like an insatiable beast. Fire roared up out of every deck on the ship, and even as the barge drifted forward, Kylar saw it wasn't going to make it to shore. A few men had the sense to tear off their armor before they leaped overboard, and others were clinging to bridge pilings. But at least 200 Highlanders would never fight on Cenarian soil. The gate behind Kylar shook as something struck it. He cursed himself. He shouldn't have stayed, shouldn't have watched while he could have been running. No Cenarian soldiers had come running during his battle, and weren't coming even now, 2 minutes after the first signal. However bad this was, whatever was happening at the castle must be worse. The gate blew apart, and witches aglow with power strode through its smoking remains. Kylar ran for the castle. Chapter 53. With Nefdada and a dozen soldiers in Cenarian livery trailing behind him, Roth sprinted across the catwalk. He reached a small room, turned right, and pounded up a narrow set of stairs. It was a dizzying maze of corridors, walkways, and service stairs, but it would get Roth and his men to the North Tower twice as fast as any other route. Time was of the essence. So many plans that Roth had planted, watered, and coaxed into bloom over the past years were bearing fruit tonight. Like a greedy child, he wanted to taste every one and let the bloody juices spill down his chin. The queen and her two younger daughters were dying right now, Roth realized with regret. It was too bad. Too bad he wouldn't get to see it. He hoped nobody would move the bodies before he could come inspect them. He'd given orders, but though he trusted Hugh Gibbet to carry them out meticulously, this was war. There was no telling what would happen. There was no help for it, though. There was no way he would have missed watching the king die. How exquisite that was! If Roth hadn't been dodging around corners, he'd have burst out laughing. He'd planned to have a bolt cranked in his crossbow and pointed at the king's forehead all night. He'd planned to be the one to kill the king himself, but Captain Arturian's security had been too tight. Roth had been able to get into the Great Hall, but he hadn't been able to bring a weapon. It had been a small disaster. If Durzo Blint hadn't come through for him, the entire plot would have failed. Father would have killed him. But it didn't fail. Durzo had come through for him, and what a virtuoso performance it had been! The poisoning of the guests had been brilliant. Roth had been in the kitchens as the food tasters had tried every dish, and not one of them had even been ill. The delivery of the king's poison had been a marvel of athleticism. The concoction itself had worked even better than Blint had promised. Roth would find more work for that man. With Durzo as his tool, Roth would dispense such exquisite agonies as he'd never before imagined. Herbs! He'd never even thought of their potential. Durzo would be just the one to guide him in all their uses. Who would have imagined that herbs given to the king would push Aegon over the edge? He had positively giggled when the Lord General had relieved the fool king of his head. It had been better than doing it himself. He'd never had the particular thrill of watching a man commit what he himself must have seen as treason. There was something very fine about seeing a man damn himself. Roth and his men had tarried in the great hall just long enough to see that the Lord General and his men had taken the bait and were on their way. And then they had run. If he had planned this right, and Roth planned everything right, he'd taste even finer fruits than Aegon's betrayal tonight. Father would be so pleased. 600 of the God King's elite Highlanders were to arrive at the castle within the next half hour. 1,000 more would arrive at dawn. The king had told Roth that he wanted to lose less than half of those by the time he arrived with an occupying army the next day. Roth thought he would lose less than a quarter, perhaps far less. He'd pass his Urdtan brilliantly. The God King would appoint Roth King of Cenaria and take the title of High King for himself. In time, he'd pass the entire empire to Roth. Pushing future glories from his mind, Roth came to a stop in the last narrow corridor as his men caught up. The door before him would open on unseen hinges into the stairway at the bottom of the North Tower. Roth motioned to his men. They slammed the hidden door open and burst into the hall, swords flashing. The two honor guards posted at the base of the tower didn't stand a chance. They barely had time to register surprise before they were dead. "We hold this door. Aegon doesn't go upstairs," Roth said. "The prince and princess are next." He checked his crossbow. Logan sat on the edge of the bed, waiting. He closed his eyes and rubbed his temples. He was, for the moment, alone in the bedchamber at the top of the North Tower. Janine Gunder, no, Janine Gyre, had left him to get ready. To get ready. Logan felt ill. He'd fantasized about lovemaking, of course, but he'd done his best to confine his desires to one woman, and that woman wasn't Janine. When Sira had accepted his proposal, he'd thought his fantasies were going to come true. They'd been planning their wedding just this morning. Now this. He heard the soft scuff of bare feet on rug and looked up. Janine's hair was down, curling luxuriantly halfway down her back. She wore a silky, translucent white gown and an anxious smile. She was breathtaking. Every hint her evening gown had given last night, God, was that only last night? Was fulfilled. Every sensuous promise exceeded. Logan's eyes drank in her curves, her hips sweeping to a narrow waist, waist swelling to those perfect breasts, curve yielding to curve with the sweetness that inspired art. He feasted on the gold of her skin in the candlelight, the darker circles of her nipples showing faintly through her gown, the flutter of her pulse at her throat, the bashfulness in her stance. He wanted her. He wanted to take her. Lust roared through him, dimming the rest of the room, swallowing all the world except the beauty before him and his thoughts of what he was about to do. He looked away, ashamed. A lump swelled in his throat and cut off his breath.
"Am I so ugly?" she asked.
He looked up and saw her arms crossed over her breasts, instant tears in her eyes. Pained, he looked away again.
"No. No, my lady. Please, come here."
She didn't move. It wasn't enough. Logan met her eyes.
"Please. You're so pretty, so beautiful, you bewilder me. You make me ache. Come sit with me, please."
Janine sat next to him on the bed, close, but not touching him. Logan had known little about her before today. Even his father had considered her too rich a match for him. He only knew that she was well-liked, sunny, settling down, and not yet 16. Logan could understand, sunny. She'd practically glowed at dinner until her father had spoken, the bastard. Logan understood now a little of how his father must have felt, seeing the woman he loved married to that. The term settling down had been applied to Janine's brother, too. For the prince, it had meant that people thought he was finally leaving off his more obvious wenching and starting to assume some of the responsibilities of ruling. But Logan imagined that for Janine, settling down probably meant she didn't play tag in the castle anymore. She was so different from Sierra. And she was his wife.
I was engaged to another woman this morning. A woman I loved for years. I still love her, Janine.
Can I call you that?
You may call me whatever pleases you, my lord husband.
Her voice was chilly. He'd hurt her. She was hurt, and for all the wrong reasons.
Damn, she was young.
But then, he hadn't been the only one who'd been handed a lot of surprises in the last day.
Have you ever been in love, Janine?
She considered his question with more gravity than he would have expected from a 15-year-old.
I've liked boys.
It's not the same, Logan snapped. He regretted his tone instantly.
Are you going to cheat on me?
She shot right back. With her? It hit Logan between the eyes. This couldn't be easy for Janine either. How must she feel, liking him, marrying him, knowing he was in love with someone else? Logan put his face in his hands.
I swore our wedding vows because the king asked me to, because the nation needed it. But I swore those vows, Janine. I will be faithful to you. I will do my duty.
And your duty to produce an heir? She asked. The chill hadn't thawed at all. He should have known better. But he answered.
Yes.
She flopped on the bed, pulling her gown up, roughly, and spread her legs. Your duty awaits, my lord, she said, turning her face away, staring at the wall.
Janine, look at me.
He covered her nakedness and, thank the gods, looked only at her face as he spoke, though even now her body cried out to him. It made him feel like an animal.
Janine, I will be as good a husband as I can, but I can't give you my heart. Not yet. I look at you and I feel wrong for wanting to make love to you. But you're my wife.
Damn it! It would be easier if you weren't so damn beautiful. If I could just look at you without wanting to do what we're supposed to do tonight.
Do you understand?
She obviously didn't, but she sat back up and folded her legs under her. Abruptly, she was a girl again, blushing for what she'd just done, but her eyes intent. Logan threw his hands up.